Item number 17, which is our annual wolf management report. It's a briefing. Dr. Martorello, welcome back. Stephanie Simic, conflict specialist.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. Again, I'm Donnie Martorello. I'm the carnivore section manager out of Olympia and manage wolves in the state, and Stephanie Simic, who is our conflict section manager out of Olympia as well. So today we have for you our annual update for 2013, implementation of our wolf conservation and management plan. We gave an update to you in October. That included much of the stuff from last January and February in our summer activity. So I'm gonna repeat some of that because I want to show a comprehensive report. This report will also be available online today on our website. And then this is also today is a PowerPoint presentation of that report, a written report we're working on right now that will be given to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and available online the first week of April on their website and ours as well. So a couple times during this presentation, again, I'll remind you that this is for the calendar year 2013, and any recent changes in January, February, and so far in March, I'll verbally give those updates to you. So a quick summary of the stuff we'll cover. I will go over the capture and monitoring that we've done through the course of the year, what that means in terms of meeting our benchmarks that we have in our plan, and the population trends that we've seen since 2008 when we had our first pack. I'll touch briefly on some of the highlights of the federal delisting proposal that's out there. Then I'll turn it over to Stephanie to talk about conflict management, livestock depredations, outreach, and then I'll wrap up with highlights on our budget for the 2013. Before I get into the numbers of it all, I want to give you a quick review of the goals of our wolf plan. It's, of course, to restore self-sustaining wolf populations in the state, to manage and reduce as much as possible wolf-livestock conflicts, to maintain a healthy prey base. Deer and elk and moose are the prey items in the state, and develop a public understanding and promote coexistence with wolves. Throughout the presentation, we have several slides of actually wolves in Washington, and I'll highlight those as well. I think folks like to see that. And for example, this is a photograph of our diamond pack here just a month ago. You can see they're enjoying a day in the sunshine there. A reminder on a couple definitions. I'll talk a little bit when I get to the numbers of it. Definition of a pack is two or more wolves traveling together in the wintertime. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's a breeding pair, just that it's two or more wolves traveling together. And then the measure of a successful breeding pair, this is a measure of reproduction. It's a male and a female wolf that raise, so it's a breeding pair that raise at least two pups that survive until the end of December. And so successful breeding pairs, we're going to talk about it in a moment. It's just that they have at least two. You know, they can have more than two that survive. And then a reminder also on our recovery objectives and our plan. Start the delisting process at state delisting process at 15 successful breeding pairs for three consecutive years that are equally distributed in our three recovery areas that you see here on the slide, or 18 successful breeding pair in a single year, also equally distributed amongst the three recovery areas. So a little about background on capture and monitoring. Of course, we've really staffed up in the last couple of years on our effort in the field, and it includes getting busier this time of year as we get close to denning season, monitoring wolves, understanding where den sites are, initiating trapping as soon as the snow melts, and taking advantage of trapping around den sites and the increased likelihood of catching wolves. We trap throughout the summertime. We also do intensive surveys through the course of the winter, getting our final population counts in December that facilitates this report. So at this point, as we've geared up over the years, we're in the field every day working with wolves. Every month, whether it's trapping or counting or cameras or snow tracking or any of those kinds of things. A big part of what we do starts in the spring when the snow melts throughout the summer until hunting season starts. Is running trap lines. We run a number of trap lines, a number of packs. We initiate this activity when we suspect there is pack level of activity. So we don't go out and set traps in areas where we just have a single sighting, those types of things. We're really looking for pack level activity or, of course, an existing pack to put radio callers out. Every animal that we catch gets a full workup. You can see here an animal with a hood on its face getting ready to put the ear tags in. That's one of the things that's been really useful for us as we identify wolves in new packs, that a lot of times we see those ear tags in photographs that hunters take or that we have on our trail cameras, and you'll see some of that in the slides coming up. This is a yearling female from the Diamond Pack back in 2010. All the wolves that we catch also get a radio collar. We use a couple different types. We still use the conventional VHF collars that you have to go out with the antenna. They last a lot longer. They're very reliable. So a portion of our animals get those kinds of collars. We're also putting collars out, the fancier, more expensive GPS collars that allow us to get a daily location several times a day back at the computer. Stephanie will talk about how we share that with some of our livestock producers. And so we continue to put those different kinds of collars out. But every wolf that we catch, unless it's a pup, gets a radio collar. Last winter, we started with using a helicopter for winter captures. A number of the western states have been doing this for several years. Here's an example of net gunning in the Diamond Pack last year. You can see just right behind the wolf in this one, just sliding out underneath the net right there. We've also used darting from a helicopter, which has been a little more successful for us. A lot of times with wolves, if they've had a helicopter over them before, they run for the trees immediately. So you only get so many opportunities with a helicopter, and they'll find that safety in the trees where you can't get to them. This is an example of that case in the Diamond Pack this last February 2013. But eventually, you know, you try to get them in the open, and for this to be successful, there has to be deep snow. Without snow, they're too fast on the landscape. We can't keep up with them. So it's snow for us to be able to do this. And then, of course, it all comes together for a capture using a helicopter. This is an example of the adult male 27M captured in the Diamond Pack last February. Just another example, this is a springtime capture this last year, a yearling female 31F. An interesting note on this one, a couple weeks after the capture, this animal was actually killed by a cougar, so we documented that. Here's one of our captures late last summer or July of last summer. This is the yearling female. I'll show a slide of this later on. She's now a two-year-old. Here's a yearling female, 36F, captured in the Ruby area. This was our first hint that maybe we had a Ruby Creek pack. I'll talk about that in a moment. We do know that there's a pair there now. And then I think some folks have seen this before, but part of the news this year was, remember, the Lookout pack was our first pack in the state in 2008. A couple years after that pack was established, it suffered some losses due to poaching. The good news is this year is that pack is now a breeding pair again and successfully raised two pups through the December. They have three pups at this point. And then, of course, back in March also of 2013, we announced the Wenatchee pack. Again, the definition being at least two animals traveling together in the wintertime, it met that definition. We do not have a collar out in this pack, and we've had just a few sightings, but still have that as identified as one of our packs in the North Cascades recovery area. Here is the revised pack map. So this is the pack status as of December 31st, 2013. And I'll walk you through some of these changes here. Of course, Tianaway, one of our long-standing larger packs, the Lookout pack that was established in 2008, there's the Wenatchee pack between Ellensburg and Wenatchee that we announced in March of last year. some of the PACs on our tribal cooperators here. And then probably the bigger news here is that last year on our PAC map, we had the Smackout PAC, which was larger, fairly large PAC in size and territory. We believe that that PAC broke up somewhere in last April. Whether the female didn't produce pups or what happened there, we're not sure. But we believe that without pups on the ground, that's the fabric that kind of holds the pack together, which is a normal dynamic process of wolf packs. I'm not suggesting that there was anything there to worry about. But that pack split up into four groups. So it established the Ruby Creek pack, the Dirty Shirt pack, and the Carpenter Ridge pack. I've already had a couple folks smile when I say the Dirty Shirt pack. Just so you know, the folks that help us discover the pack, even if that's a resident of the area or a hunter or that's collecting the trail camera pictures, we let those folks name the pack. And so that's where these names come from. So again, the big news here is that, one of the noteworthy items is that the Smackout pack is broken into four separate packs. I'll show a slide about this in a moment, talk about what that means for us. And then some packs that we've had on the landscape for a number of years, Salmo, Diamond. We continue to have a couple individuals in the Wedge pack. We believe that's a pack of two, and I'll show that number here in a moment. And then also, as you can see, the border packs. Border packs now are ones that likely den, or we know that they den outside of the state, but we like to show that on our pack map so that folks understand that other packs, they don't obviously know the boundaries that range into Washington, particularly in the Blue Mountains. These animals from the Wenaha are frequently seen, and it helps that public understand that, yes, we know that there's wolves in the Blue Mountains. It's part of the Oregon packs, we believe, at this point, that travel up fairly frequently into Washington. The other highlight here on the map is, of course, there are 13 confirmed packs. I'll show the table here next. And so they're all blue this year. No suspected packs that we've had on the pack map this last year that were gray. If it's a circle, we do not have a radio collar in it. That's a representation of what we think that pack territory is. It's the average home range size of Washington packs in terms of the size of that circle. And then the polygons are ones where we either have an active radio collar or we've had in the past, and we have an estimate of their territory. So here's what that looks like in a table. Again, I have it divided up here by the recovery region, 13 confirmed packs. Diamond pack was a successful breeding pack this last year, or a successful breeding pair. They raised at least two pups to the end of December, as did Huckleberry and the Salmo pack in the eastern recovery region, and then the Lookout pack and Tianaway pack in the northern Cascades recovery region. In terms of statewide, successful breeding pairs is at five this year. I'll show a trend here in a moment, how that compared to the past years. Our minimum count is 52, up from one last year. We've had 12 captures in the calendar year of 2013. And then this particular column, this is actually the number of animals that we had active collars on, literally on the day, December 31st, 2013. I'm going to highlight for you now what we've done since then, so you have a better reflection of what's out there currently. The other thing I was going to mention here is that last year, as well as providing the estimates of successful breeding pair and minimum count, we also provided an upper population estimate. And the way we generated that last year is that we took an average pack size from our neighbors in the Rocky Mountain area of eight. We have an expansion factor that accounts for dispersers and lone wolves of 12.5%. And we generated an estimate, an upper bounds of about 101 last year. This year we did not do that, and the reason is we had much more intensive monitoring throughout the year. And so a lot of these packs where the minimum count is just two animals, we're fairly certain it's two animals. And so it didn't seem appropriate to apply an average pack size of eight to those areas. And so at this point we have not generated an upper estimate. That being said, we know there are more than 52 animals out there. Exactly how many, we don't know, but we certainly know that there are more. That is a minimum count. The other points I'd like to make on this slide is in the eastern Washington recovery region, we did have one lone wolf with a radio collar. That was originally back in April, a member of the Smackout pack. That is the individual that is reported as a poached animal and under investigation right now. And then we also have a lone animal that's wearing a radio collar in the North Cascades recovery area, and I'll touch on that one in a moment. That's an animal that was, after December 31st, was actually recovered as another cougar kill just this last Thursday. So since then, what the activity we've done is, so I've just showed you a slide that talked about the numbers December 31st, 2013. We've been busy through February and March with more captures. In the Ruby Creek area, we've recaptured the female that already had a collar from the springtime, put a new collar on her. We also collared the other wolf of the two. It's another two-year-old female, and put a collar on her as well. And then we went over to the Tianaway. We caught two additional adult female wolves in the Tianaway in February, put radio collars on both of them. And then we had that dispersing male that was a member of the Tianaway pack and was somewhere in this region around the Wenatchee or the Clockham area. We recollared that one also in late February, put a new collar on it, and then a week later it was killed by a cougar, the one I just mentioned, the loner. And then yesterday we caught an adult male in the Diamond Pack, M4, Scott Becker actually has to get back and look at his database. It was an animal, obviously, that we caught before. It had the ear tag in it. He suspects it's an animal that had a radio collar that had the time release on it, and we've recollared the animal. It did not have a collar when he captured it yesterday. We put a new collar on that one as well. And then the other highlight is that we did have a sighting north of Ellensburg of a single wolf. Don't know if that was a male or female. Suspect it was a female. It was hanging around northern Ellensburg for a week or so after the first of the year, and we have not seen that animal since. So here's the Ruby Creek female. She's going to be a two-year-old this April. This is one that we caught last summer, captured her recently, put a new collar on her. This is the other female from the Ruby Creek pack, also, we believe, a two-year-old female, 37F, that we caught the next day. And Scott Becker working the animal up there. This is the dispersing male that was originally from the Tianaway, was in the Wenatchee pack kind of vicinity, recollared that also in February, and recovered that, killed by a cougar, confirmed killed by a cougar, recovered that on Thursday. One of the interesting stories is this particular wolf. We talked about this in October, and I have more to add to this story. This is originally a pup from, my pointer finally died, oh there it is. Originally a pup from the Tianaway pack that was captured and put ear tags in it. And then the next time we saw this animal, it was photographed in the NTAT, a great photograph here by a member of the public. We could actually zoom in and read the ear tags on this female and know that she was that pup from Tianaway. She was photographed in the NTAT last year. And now this is the animal that we just caught back in the Tianaway in late February. So she's now back in the Tianaway as an adult female. So we continue to get all the locations from all those collared animals. A number of those collars are those nicer GPS collars where we get the real-time information. So we have a growing database of collar activity. I showed this also in October. Takeaway message here is that pretty big landscape now, Washington, we have collared wolves on. Wolves do tremendous movements. That's nothing new to us. We know that from our neighbors and other states. We've all heard about OR7 in Oregon. We've heard from Mike Jimenez in past months about what they saw in the Rocky Mountain region. So they are very mobile and great colonizers. So nothing unusual here. I also want to touch on the documented mortalities and in 2013, and then I'll highlight the ones that we've had since then. I'm going to break this down a couple different ways. These are the mortalities during that period of time, January 1st, December 31st, 2013, within the state of Washington. Maybe my pointer will work a little bit here. Here is the picture I showed of the yearling female from Tianaway that was killed by a cougar. This is the uncollared, un-ear-tagged animal that was a vehicle-wolf collision at Blewett Pass. And then we had a legal harvest on the Spokane Indian Reservation by a tribal member, and another human-caused mortality on the Spokane Reservation by a tribal member, and then a self-defense take by a deer hunter in the Pasayton. Also during this time, we had two animals that originated from Washington that had radio collars on them that were legally taken in B.C. Both of those animals were from the smack out. You just saw them on the last slide. Those were the dispersing animals. So that's for 2013, five in the state, two that originated and were lawfully taken in British Columbia. So far in 2014, since then, we've had the male that I just talked about that we recovered on Thursday. It was killed by a cougar. We have a poaching case under investigation that was the solitary animal that was originally from Smackout. And then we've had also two additional animals that originated from Washington. That one was lawfully taken in BC, and another one that was a member of the Diamond Pack that was lawfully taken in Idaho. That's in 2014. A lot of information there. In terms of what these numbers mean and trends, all good positive trends that we like to see on a pathway to recovery. This is a trend in the minimum number of wolves in Washington. Again, emphasizing and stressing this is the minimum count. We know there are more than this. In fact, when we talk with our neighbors in the Rocky Mountain states, not only are there more wolves than this, but also in terms of the packs we know, we have 13 confirmed packs right now. We also know that we're not seeing all the packs. We know from the other states that you're typically aware of about 70% of the packs. And so there are likely other packs out there that we haven't discovered yet, and dispersers, and et cetera. But nonetheless, a good trend of an increasing wolf population. Here's the trend in the number of successful breeding pair, very similar. This last year, both at five, that's nothing that I would be alarmed at. What you don't see here, this is just a measure of baseline recruitment, at least two pups surviving to the end of the year. Of course, there are packs that have more than two pups that survive, so this is not a measure of how many pups hit the ground, just that what met the minimum bar of that success, or two that reached the end of the year. But again, looking from 2008, a good trend line. And seeing the same thing with a trend in the confirmed number of packs, as we expected and we've talked about in past years, we're on this path very similar to Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming of a rapidly expanding and growing wolf population. This is an overlay of those 13 packs and the border packs over the estimated suitable habitat in the state. We've talked about this before. We continue to see wolf populations in northeastern Washington pack in over what we predicted to be the suitable habitat in the state. Of course, there is some more habitat in the area, and we'll likely see packs are a very dynamic thing, and so these are not static. You'll continue to see packs shift and new names and new packs as other packs break up or whatever happens to them, new packs established. It'll continue to be very dynamic in northeastern Washington, but we are getting closer to that saturation of packs on the available or on the suitable habitat, and we're expecting to see a lot of growth in the remaining recovery areas, North Cascades and the Southern Cascades and Northwest Coastal region, where there is a lot of vacant suitable habitat. Switching gears real quickly, talk a little bit about the federal delisting proposal. Last June, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced a proposal in the Federal Register to do a couple different things. to remove gray wolves from the lower 48 from the Federal Endangered Species Act, to maintain the listing status of the Mexican wolf subspecies, and to change the taxonomic structure of the eastern wolf from a subspecies to a full species. We're going to focus on number one here that's relevant for Washington, and that's the removal at a species level gray wolves from the Federal Endangered Species Act. So in this, I know this is difficult to see, in this shaded area, the larger box, wolves are federally delisted. This is the Northern Rocky Mountain Distinct Population Segment. They are also federally delisted in the Western Great Lakes DPS. The dark shaded areas are the living wolf populations in those states. And then there is an experimental area around the subspecies of the Mexican wolf in the Southwest. The proposal by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is then to delist at a species level this remaining light gray area. For Washington, this is extremely relevant for us. We actually, part of the state is already federally delisted. It was a part of the Northern Rocky Mountain Distinct Population Segment. So the eastern third of the state is federally delisted. The entire state is state listed. The western two-thirds of the state is federally listed. We have provided comments to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service supporting their proposal to delist in Washington State. Part of that rationale and justification and support of that is that, of course, we have a recovery plan in place that we're proud of, a comprehensive recovery plan that's a pathway for recovery for Washington State. We have adequate regulatory mechanisms in place. We have an active and ongoing monitoring program recovering this pathway to recovery, or monitoring this pathway to recovery. We have good connectivity with jurisdictions on three sides of us, BC, Idaho, and Oregon, where we continue to have dispersal from. We're observing rapid population growth, just like the Northern Rocky Mountains. Our packs, we have animals out there, the diamond member that we just captured yesterday was a 6 or 7 year old animal. So we have multiple age classes, which is a sign of a healthy growing wolf population. We have an active outreach and education program and what we believe is a adaptive management program to deal with conflict and potentially impacts on ungulates. And so we have all of these things in place. Delisting is what was a known process that we knew was coming down the road eventually. We think we're ready for that. And so our support of a federally delisting. Now, part of the Federal Register focused on, in terms of the rationale and some of the background work for delisting, the proposal by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, highlighted the taxonomy or the genetic structure of wolf populations in the lower 48. I'm going to talk a little bit about one of the manuscripts that was a part of that. It's called the Chambers et al. 2011. And it was really the background in terms of what are the subspecies out there, what are the full species out there, and what is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife proposing to do. So in that, here is the gray wolf, the subspecies Nubilis. And I'll talk a moment about this and what that means in Washington. Occidentalis is a subspecies that was used for recolonizing Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. The eastern wolf that they're proposing to go to a species level, and then the subspecies, the Mexican wolf, Baileyi. So recently, the taxonomic structure has been one of debate in the federal proposal. Because of that, recently, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did contract out for an independent review by geneticists on that taxonomic structure that was contracted through UCLA. And that's not necessarily a new thing. They do that often in their delisting programs and work that they do. And in that review, one of the noteworthy portions of that is they did hear back that unanimously of those reviewers that the best available science, it did not use that manuscript and a portion of their Federal Register did not adhere to the best available science. And so that review is available online. on their website. They have also initiated another public comment period, which ends the last week of March. At this point, we're still anticipating that they'll have a final decision in June. When they initiated the rule last June, they said that it would take them about a year. So what does this mean for Washington and from our perspective? Well, we continue to see a very rapid colonization in this state, recovery in this state. Subspecies that is colonizing northeastern Washington is this Occidentalis subspecies. We do have a mix of Nubilis and Occidentalis in the North Cascades recovery area. When I say that, we have a member that may be Nubilis, and we know that of a breeding pair, and a member that's Occidentalis, and of course their pups are a full mix of those two subspecies, and we've detected that in the Lookout Pack and the Tianaway Pack. And so what that means is that we really see Washington as a wave of recovery that's occurring from east to west that is dominated by this Occidentalis. We have what may be a mixing pot in the North Cascades of the two. And under our plan, which is a recovery at a species level, just gray wolves, it allows that to sort itself out naturally. And if there is a benefit to a particular subspecies, Nubilis, that may occur in the more western sides of Washington coastal environments, perhaps, our plan allows that to naturally occur. So we're not managing at a subspecies level. We're managing at a species level, and it allows for that nature to take its course and for the right animal to find the right habitats. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Stephanie to talk about the conflict.
Excuse me, Donnie. Since this is a good moment to follow up a question on that point, state law calls for management at the species level. What about federal law? And maybe you're not the right person to discuss federal laws, requirements for protection at the subspecies level. What's your sense? I'm not going to hold you to
this. That's a good question. Probably the only part I can add to that or provide is that the ruling is at a species level. And so the ruling that affects Washington The proposal, the Federal Register, the proposal to delist in the lower 48 of the species gray wolves, Canis lupus, is at a species level. It does not specify Nubilis or a subspecies for the lower 48, with the only exception being Baileyi, which is the Mexican wolf subspecies. And so it is a federal proposal for gray wolves is at a species level.
Do you want to add anything, Nate? If you do, come forward. And
thanks, Madam Chair. Nate Pamplin with the Wildlife Program. I'll try to talk. Under ESA, there is three classifications that the service can list: the species, the subspecies, and the distinct
population.
I've got
you some cough drops if you'd like.
So if I understood your question correctly, as far as in terms of the rule, it really is just that's the classification under ESA. And so they had currently listed, as Donnie indicated, at the species level, and they're going back and then refining their subspecies designations for continued conservation in the east and in the southwest.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sure we'll have to have more conversations about this in light of the question that has been raised about whether we should rethink our support for federal delisting. So we'll just need to explore, you know, does this change? Does this peer review actually change anything in terms of the logic and the rationale? So thanks, and here's some cough drops.
And under state law, we have the ability to list under by rule. Your rule is by species and subspecies.
Okay, thanks.
We'll get this adjusted here. Okay. Madam Chair, Commissioners, Deputy Director, and guests, thank you for this opportunity. I always get excited when I get this chance to speak in front of you about this fantastic program that we started. Donnie gets all the fun stuff of, you know, tackling the animals and having fun with the captures and tackling all the issues regarding the listing and all. But I get the fun stuff of working with the folks out in the field that are actually possibly impacted by the recovery of wolves and being creative, working with partners and collaboration and trying to come up with some good ideas and new techniques for conflict management. So, again, thank you. I'm excited to share this information with you. As Donnie mentioned, we are going to probably repeat some of the things we discussed in October, trying to give you an annual report on what we've been doing for conflict management. As you know, the wildlife program has expanded tremendously with the conflict side of the world. We created some new positions and have a lot of folks out in the field now, boots on the ground, so to speak, to be there to help producers and help residents of these different areas dealing with a variety of conflict issues, not just wolf, but other species as well. So we'll get started with just going through. I want to remind everybody that we do encourage reports from the public, and of course, if it's a conflict issue, we want to hear about it right away. So we've got several mechanisms for folks to report issues and report sightings regarding conflict, especially with the wolf side of the world. We encourage folks to use the hotline. That's 24 hours a day. We also have arrangements with counties and receive calls through the 911 systems. We do have online opportunities for folks to report sightings. I also want to say that because we've got boots on the grounds, a lot of folks have our conflict specialists' personal phone numbers, and they call them directly to report any concerns or incidents regarding wolf conflict issues. We always encourage the use of the pamphlets and outreach materials that we have. We try to share them as we meet with folks in the field, and then also encourage folks to always go on to our webpage, try to keep that up to date as much as possible. With the reports, the online reporting system, this was active all last year. You can see we received quite a few reports. It's a really simple form for folks to fill out if they have any information they want to report, a wolf sighting or a track or something like that. They can do so. We have a little cheat sheet to help them kind of discern between coyotes and wolves because it's quite frankly not that easy. So we try to help folks out so we can get some fairly valid reports. As you can see across the state, we had quite a few reports, and some of them are probably areas that you wouldn't expect wolves, or we don't know if there are wolves there yet. And that's probably so. It's probably certain that maybe some of those aren't as accurate as we had hoped, but it is important for us to get these reports because it helps us kind of track where we want to send Donnie's great carnivore research team out to try to see if we can capture some animals and get some more on the air. It also helps us to find out where we might be anticipating or future thinking about conflict issues and be able to get our people out there to start working with folks on the ground and make folks aware of the preventative measures that are available. Just to kind of go through this, we also receive a lot of trail cam pictures, which is kind of fun to look at. It's always fun for us because we're often stuck behind the desk, and those guys are out there in the field doing the fun stuff. So when we get pictures, it's always fun to kind of go through the office and say, what do you think this is? Is it a wolf or is it a coyote? But just for some examples, here are some photos that we've received, and you can see it's kind of tough to tell. Is it a wolf or is it a coyote? We always encourage folks to, again, look at the cheat sheet and remind yourselves of, you know, the bushy tail, pointed ears, narrow, more feminine-looking nose. It's probably a coyote. And so in these pictures, you can see this is actually a coyote. These were actually coyotes on this road. In fact, I think this is the one that they reconfirmed coyotes just by tracks as well. But here's another one, full-on front shot, nice. You know, if somebody's thinking that's a coyote or a wolf, excuse me, especially because of the coloring. I mean, you look at that. Ooh, it's kind of hard to see. Can you all see in your pamphlet? Well, if you look at that photo, the coloring really kind of goes, oh, maybe it is a wolf. But really take a good look at those ears. They're pointed. That nose is really narrow, looks almost fox-like in a way. That's definitely a coyote. But then we get bonus photos like this one, which, in fact, is a wolf. And it helps us determine where these wolves are active. We see photos like this come through, and we really start to celebrate in the office knowing that we've got one that actually was a wolf. And this kind of information is really helpful. We keep encouraging the public to provide this information to us through email or online systems or phone calls or through the conflict specialists. So it's always fun for us to go through those. We spoke last time in October about the prevention measures that we're putting in place. We're still very active on that. We're, in fact, more recently, we've been doing a lot more of projects that we call improving fencing, improving existing fencing. A lot of the producers are actually doing a lot of these techniques up front, but there are little spots where we can help them and improve their prevention efforts for minimizing conflict. A lot of the tools that we've been really emphasizing have been the range riders and the fladry because it's very effective. But the one that was really interesting last year for us was the collar data sharing. It was, you know, a lot of our colleagues in other states thought, oh, you're crazy if you're going to share the data with producers. You don't know what's going to happen. But we took the risk because you've got to build trust with these people. And if they can trust us, we can trust them, and we can work together to be a successful program. And so in doing so, we built this collar data sharing program with certain producers that had that actually had cattle allotments out in the open range to help them kind of monitor when we may have wolves in the area and so that they could better monitor their cattle. We also had some arrangements and agreements with some of the counties so that they could also work with their constituents in their areas and let folks know, hey, there are wolves in the area. Make sure, you know, you've got somebody out there on your cattle doing the monitoring. The other big one is the sanitation issue, just removing those bone piles, removing the carcasses, the injured animals, getting them off the range so that we're not producing an attractant there for wolves. We do all of these things regardless of whether or not we have a damage prevention cooperative agreement. We provide this type of technical assistance to all entities. But the Damage Prevention Cooperative Agreement is a new program that we started, and it allows for cost sharing for some of these techniques. And it also allows the producer a little bit more leeway in what he wants to do and working directly one-on-one with our conflict specialists and trying to really find the package that fits his operation, really tailoring all these techniques to his operation. We've had 29 contracts signed or agreements signed over the year, and it's been fairly successful. In fact, at this point, we've actually had three people sign up for the new fiscal year. Even though it's, you know, only March, they're ready for the new fiscal year. So it's very exciting. The damage prevention cooperative agreements have helped us really reach out to the livestock producers and the landowners. And most of those folks are deploying the sanitation methods and the range riding, and then some of them are using some variety of hazing techniques. What's really fun about working with them on these agreements is it really gives us an opportunity to be creative with their operation and see what tools can we come up with together that might actually work really well for their particular site. And as I mentioned before in the October meeting, is that we were working on pilot projects, and that included the pilot sanitation carcass removal project. We are partnering up on some research projects, and we had contracted an outreach project. And I'm going to talk about those a little bit later down the road here. Let's talk about the wolf's livestock depredations. That's what everybody always wants to know. How many depredations did we have? You know, what did you do? What did you find? Those sorts of things. Last year, for 2013, we actually investigated 20 different depredation events. And of those 20, only four were caused by wolves. Actually, half of the depredation events were non-wolf depredations. We did have five that were unknown or undetermined, but they were not caused by a predator or a carnivore. So, you know, we're not veterinarians. We do the best we can to determine what animal might have caused any injury or death. If it's beyond that, it's beyond our scope of work. So, but it's interesting to note that, you know, of those 10 that were non-wolf depredations, We had some really varied causes. I mean, structural, you know, injuries that caused a death, maybe running into a barbed wire fence, things like that. We had a couple of cows that drowned, things like that. So it's interesting for us to capture this data because it helps us understand what other impacts the cattle are having, you know, what other impacts things are having on the cattle so that we can then address those when we go to this livestock producer's property. If we see there's maybe a structural something in their fencing or their shed that might cause a damage, we can encourage them to improve that site so that they won't have these kinds of mortalities as well or injuries. Another big thing for us was developing the Wolf Advisory Group. This was an exciting process for me personally. We started out, I think, 2 weeks here in the agency, and we had our first Wolf Working Group meeting. So I was pretty excited. It got me a chance to meet everybody. And then it evolved into this advisory group with a stated mission of, you know, bringing these diverse stakeholders together to help advise the agency in the implementation of the Wolf Plan. And these advisory group members, there are 9 of them. They're all appointed by the director. And they have 2 main directives, which is one, to advise us on the implementation of the plan, but also to act as the review board for compensation when we do have livestock losses. It's been a really challenging process working through some of the issues that we've had to deal with, and it's been very enlightening for me to see all the different perspectives of how wolves will affect folks across the landscape. One of the things that one of the developments we most recently did was to create our website for the Wolf Advisory Group. And the nice thing about this is it allows anyone to access the agenda items, the materials that were given out. It actually allows you to look at the minutes for the meetings. You'll have the dates and times of the upcoming meetings. There's also a place in there that you can look at the members list to see who's on the stakeholders group. And it gives an opportunity for folks to even call in or email if they have questions about the advisory group. This group's been really helpful for us in our outreach component as well, which I'll talk about a little bit later. So on outreach, our staff is constantly involved in trying to present any material regarding wolf recovery and wolf management in the state, including the conflict side of the world. We've been involved in over 50 different meetings, and they range from, you know, small little maybe a group at a school meeting to panel, acting as a panel member. We've been very active in trying to reach out to the public at various levels, so the general public, specialty groups, things like that. We've tried to offer depredation trainings and range rider trainings for folks who were involved in those events or who are interested in those events, just trying to get more information about how we do our process. How do we do the depredation investigations, and what does it mean when we come back with a probable wolf depredation? So we've been doing that, and we plan to continue to do that. We had, I think, 3 depredation trainings last year in total and 2 range rider trainings. We continue to use our news releases and our printed materials, the brochures, the hunting pamphlets, the magnets. We're always trying to improve those and update those as we go and encourage other entities to use those materials in their outreach efforts as well. Collaboration is really the success for this conflict issue. We need to work with everybody. Online resources are one of our main tools. We've used, obviously, the web page, and like I said, we just created that Wolf Advisory Group web page to help folks understand what the advisory group is looking at. But we also post our staff reports. We conducted the webinar last summer when we brought in the other managers from adjacent states who dealt with wolf issues. And that's still online, so folks can still reference that and listen to that at their leisure and pick up different points of material from that. We continue to use our sightings report, and, you know, as we just discussed, it is kind of challenging. Sometimes you don't know if those sightings are as accurate as we hope, but it allows people to at least let us know what they're seeing in the field or what they think they're seeing. And then, of course, we have other outlets that we use. But the Wolf Advisory Group actually has been a fairly good outlet for us. They take back the information to their constituents, and they're always involved in a variety of outreach efforts on their own. And so through that, we've been able to expand the information that we're trying to share and spread the word that, hey, we're here to help. We've got a conflict section now that's addressing these issues. If you have ideas, by all means, share them with us. We're open for discussion. And then, of course, we did contract with Western Wildlife Outreach for this outreach effort, recognizing that we needed to broaden our perspective. We really needed to – we can't do it all. It's got to be a collaborative effort. We've got to build these relationships with our partners and try to share our information and what we're learning with them so they can share it with folks that they generally work with. And in doing that, we decided – it's probably best to contract with someone to help us develop those programs and develop an outreach specific agenda. And in doing so, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the first component of the outreach project that Western Wildlife Outreach is doing. We recognized that we needed to reach out to the wolf, to the livestock producers on wolf issues. We also needed to reach out to the general public, and we need to reach out to hunters. So the first segment of their effort is to try to create a wolf livestock conflict avoidance program. And what does that mean? Well, what we recognize is that there are other entities like the conservation districts and Washington State University Ag Extension units that work with these producers quite frequently, even U.S. Forest Service with the grazing allotments. And if we could work with those entities and share with them the knowledge base that we have and the information we're sharing with the producers one-on-one, and we're all speaking the same language and they have the same tools, then they can reach yet a greater audience and help us get this information out. So we're working collaboratively with WSU Extension and the conservation districts, and Western Wildlife Outreach is creating what we call a multimedia approach. They're creating what they actually coined as a train the trainers workshop. And the idea is that we would have both a video component, an actual handbook of these tools and these preventative measures and these techniques, and then some hands-on demonstration. This is the proper way to set up flaggery. This is not the proper way to do it. If you see this on your producer's property, help them get it corrected. So we're going to be they're developing that right now, and we're going to be offering these workshops. Right now I think we're planning on four for the upcoming year, that will actually invite conservation district personnel, Washington Wildlife, Ag Extension folks, U.S. Forest Service folks to come learn about these techniques from our staff, from others who have been involved in it, and then be able to take that information back to their constituents and the folks that they're working with daily. I'm really optimistic and excited about this program because I think it's going to help us really reach a greater audience, and I think folks will start to really understand how these things work and where they can and cannot be effective. So I'm very excited about this opportunity. Looking forward to seeing what we can achieve in the next year. Our outreach also goes through scientific research. Of course, everything we want to do, we want to have it based in science. And as most people, and even before this discussion, we had the public speaking, and they were saying, you know, the science is not there on these things, and the science is there on other things. So we recognize we need some science. And so we're partnering with Washington State University Large Carnivore Conservation Lab to look specifically at these conflict issues. And it's a multi-part research project. They have two PhD students that they've already brought on board and two master's students that they've already brought on board. We are, as an agency, having our personnel, or at least one member of our personnel, on each of those students' committees so that we can help advise and be a part of the process of developing and making sure that we're actually researching the things that we feel we need that will help us in the long run. The research, although the students have started and they're actually on board and getting ready and working on their proposals and working with our staff, the actual research begins this spring. We're going to be looking at various levels of conflict issues. We're going to do a full assessment of what's been of we call it a risk assessment, but all the activities that have occurred in like the adjacent states, Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, we're going to look at their databases and see where did their conflicts occur and what parameters may have been driving those conflicts, and then see if we can adjust that to Washington. Does that apply to Washington? Are we seeing similar events here? Our conflicts are nowhere near as high as theirs are as far as a database, but we might be able to get some ideas and seeing where trends might occur. Another component of it is actually looking at the preventative measures, trying to see what's effective, what's not effective, and assessing the value of each of these tools that we're putting out there. And then we're also going to look at the wolf-livestock interaction. How are they interacting together across the landscape in these open range areas and these more concentrated allotments? We have different scenarios that we're putting out there, or at least hopefully going to be putting out there. It's going to involve tagging cattle and collaring cattle just as much as tagging wolves and collaring wolves. So it's a pretty exciting project, and it's very I think it's very cutting edge, to be honest with you. I think we're in the lead of something here really good. So looking forward to that. That, of course, involves multiple partners. Again, you know, not just WSU and ourselves, but we're working with the Forest Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and all these other entities are involved. Again, a collaborative effort. And then we also are, as I've been saying throughout my presentation, that we always test new techniques. We want to try new things. We want to see if we can improve upon what we've got. We want to see if there are other ways that folks haven't thought about things, and can we bring these new tools into place. And one of the things we're working on right now is this pilot, what we call pilot carcass removal project. And we're partnering with Conservation Northwest and Washington Conservation Districts to try to look at different ways that we can help producers minimize impacts with having boneyards and things like that, removing the idea of a boneyard and bringing it to a carcass location, a carcass disposal location, where we would then compost the carcasses rather than just bury them. And in just kind of exploring this idea, we've gotten some information from some Montana and some other folks who have done this. But just looking across the state, we see it's done in a variety of ways across the state now, just with our own agencies. You know, DOT has different ways that they handle carcasses. We have different ways we handle carcasses. The producers have different ways. So we're trying to bring all those ideas together. And in some locations, we'll be able to just improve on the techniques that they're doing. And in other locations, we may be creating new compost locations and trying to offer opportunities for producers to bring their carcasses to those locations or contract individuals to help those producers get those carcasses to the locations. So it's going to involve multiple locations. Right now we're looking at mostly the northeast region where we have most of our wolf packs, the north central region where we see there's an expanding area, and then central Washington. And then also, you know, we're hoping that some of this can be operational by this spring, but we realize that some of it's going to be a gradual approach. Some of them will be operational and others may not be up quite as soon as we'd like. But it's been a great effort so far, and I'm really optimistic where we're going to be going with this. I think we're going to have some good success, and I think producers are going to really appreciate this. And the nice thing about working with these two entities is they bring a whole different component to it, and the conservation districts are able to bring a different side and be able to help us really broaden what we're able to do with these producers. It's been a wonderful interaction. Okay, so future efforts. Well, we want to continue that one-on-one. We've made such great progress with having our conflict staff be able to be out there on the landscape with those producers, working one-on-one, looking at their particular operation and adjusting things for their operation. We want to expand our effort to work with the local governments. Again, you know, I mentioned before, we want to try to bring in some of these other entities. Another entity that we've talked about is veterinarians, trying to bring them into the picture and understanding depredations and how they can help us. We're constantly working on outreach, wanting to work on outreach and research, and I think the next report we give to you, we'll probably have some really good information to provide on those two components. Hopefully you'll read about them before, and in good ways, before we present the information, but hopefully you'll hear all about the good stuff we're doing. Obviously, continue training and expanding our collaborative efforts with training other folks and getting ourselves trained up on the current and latest and greatest techniques. And continue testing techniques and remain adaptive. I mean, as Donnie mentioned before, wolf management really is an adaptive process. And I think that's why I like this position so much, because it is adaptive. We get to be creative. We get to have fun, and we get to tackle serious issues at the same time and hopefully improve what we're doing on the landscape with the recovery of wolves. I'll turn this over to Donnie. Okay. You want to sit here?
Home stretch here, our last slide. Wanted to give you a quick update on expenditures. In October, we kind of looked at the biennial budget, which is a number of about 1.7 over all these same categories. A reminder that we do have, at this point in time, again, not knowing kind of what the future holds and the workload and the differences, but we have a funded program. And excited about that. That's a lot of help recently with the personalized license plate increase that we got this last year. This is a reflection of the breakdown of expenditures for the fiscal year. We typically don't show it by fiscal year, so that's why you know, it's a little different than the, just half of the 1.7. We share it with the Wolf data with U.S. Fish and Wildlife under our agreements with them on a fiscal year in terms of reports and also of expenditures. So that's why today I'm sharing it with you as a fiscal year. You'll see later on, of course, the biennial wrap-up. Just real quickly, this last year we do have a contract with U.S. Fish or with WSU for that research that Stephanie was talking about. That'll be an expense coming up over the next 2 years. She also talked and highlighted the outreach project that we have with Western Wildlife Outreach. The control stuff, the contract work with Wildlife Services, at this point, obviously, we haven't done any control work over this last year. This is also Wildlife Services does more than that for us. They also do all of the preventative and capture work and those kinds of things. So they now have a dedicated wolf staff that helps us do all the same sorts of things that we do. It's just a different hat. You can see here the expenses associated with the monitoring and the captures and those kinds of things. And then the rollout that Stephanie talked about of the 12 conflict specialists and obviously more money, more expenditures in northeastern Washington where we have several packs on the ground. And then the typical radio collars and flights and those kinds of things that we've done over the last fiscal year. We do have $300,000 of the 1.7 that is earmarked specifically for compensation and did not pay out any claims this last year. So that's the conclusion of our program. Again, just two reminders that this full slide presentation is probably on our website already. If not, it will be today. And then the paper version of this report will be available the first week of April and will be on our website and also U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. With that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Very, very nice job, you guys. Just extremely impressive, the amount of work that you've put into this, the progress we've made, just truly impressive. Commissioner Schmitten?
Thank you, Chair. And Donnie and Stephanie, you know, I always feel that I'm privileged to be able to receive your report. You're both so professional, and you do an outstanding job. I want to hone in on the 2013 population estimates, and that would be slide 27, which is the minimum numbers going from 51 to 52, and slide 29, which shows the PAC numbers going to 9 to 13. In fact, in the PAC numbers, Donnie, I wrote down a quote from you. It's a good trend in WOOF, of WOOF increasing population. What I want to be able to be sure I can tell the public is an accurate answer to the minimum number going only up one. And I'm, in my mind, I suspect that it's a function of the ability to spot the animals during the aerial survey at one point in time. Otherwise, you can only count what you count, and that gives you a number. And that's probably why you identify it as a minimum number. But I'm sure the public is going to see the number, especially the minimum number, going up. They're going to see the PAC numbers increasing by quite a bit. Why do we tell them as far as the minimum number being only one up?
I think you've nailed it there, is that you're absolutely right. It's just what we see. All the PACs, we have multiple efforts to try to get a minimum number. In some cases, it's two or three flights over the pack, or in other cases like the wedge, it's several days on a snowmobile or out on snowshoes trying to cut tracks and see how many animals there are based on tracks in the snow. But it is just that. It's what we observe on those occasions that we're over that pack. And, of course, the minimum number would get closer and closer to the actual number of the pack if we were out there every single day just trying to count how many are in that pack, but we're not able to do that. And so it's for the days that we're over them in the air or on the snowshoes doing those things, what's the minimum number that we see? You did talk about also the trend in the number of wolf packs. That really is the building blocks. That's the unit of a wolf population. It's a pack. And that really is the building block for reproduction and ultimately recovery. And so we are seeing this increasing trend each year of the number of packs. A number of those packs we think are smaller right now because of issues like the smack out breaking up into four independent packs. Those will all be breeding packs very soon. And pretty soon you set yourself up for that. Those kinds of increases that we're going to be seeing over the course of the years. And so I would emphasize, again, the count is just a bare minimum and try to tell folks not to get caught up in that it just it's one number different than last year. Really look at the other elements as well, particularly the number of wolf packs and the trend we see there.
Thank you.
Stephanie?
Yeah, if I could add to that, I think Donnie touched on it, but you know, folks might say, well, we only had increased by one, but we have all these packs now. Well, it's because we had the split up, the breakup of those other smack out packs. So we went from one smack out pack to possibly four other packs. And I think that's where people get the disconnect. They don't recognize that. If we can convey to them, well, this pack went from one of nine members, now it's four different packs, but they only are two members each. That might help people understand why the pack increases, but the number doesn't necessarily.
We've got lots of hands up. Commissioner Smith first.
Yeah, very informative. I appreciate the effort on public outreach. I think it's absolutely critical. The fact that there was one calf taken, I would hope, goes a long way to alleviate some of the fear that we've heard over and over. I'm not sure that will accommodate some groups out there that rely on talk radio too much, but that's an editorial statement. I think in terms of the research directions, I would find it very interesting if as the thesis and dissertation topics are identified, if you could share those, because I think that is a wise use of funding, and I think it brings in cutting-edge research that's there, and I would be interested to know what directions you're looking at, because that may help us in trying to look at some other directions to focus on future graduate studies. So, thank you again.
Absolutely.
Commissioner Caney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to say I get a chance to, well, first off, a great presentation, both Donnie and Stephanie, and I get a chance to work with Stephanie some in the field, and just want to say how professional she is, and I think what she's bringing to the public in terms of knowing that the WFW takes this seriously, you know, that conflict avoidance by the work that she does, and then the staff people that are in the communities, it's huge. I mean, it's just we can do it different, I think, than other states, and I think that this shows that we are trying to, and we are doing every effort as a state organization to make it, you know, go as smooth as we can. I do have a question, and I think maybe the next user group that might need to have some attention and deserve not as big an effort, but the hunting organizations and the whole concept of, you know, they're kind of that next affected user group almost. Mm-hmm. And just so that we, I think, as a state agency, have a clear path, a clear person that they can contact, the public can go to and say, well, who do they talk about when it comes to ungulate numbers? And there's so much research going on now and good data that I think we want to do the same thing with that major user group as we're doing with livestock, not necessarily more staff, but just have a good pattern of how to get that information out, who do they contact, keep the facts and the science up front, you know, lower the rhetoric. So that's just a suggestion, I guess, or a question if we're going to be thinking along those lines.
A great comment. We are. With the first thing, obviously, that we're tackling is the wolf livestock conflict issue. And that's reflective in our wolf advisory group, where right now, when you look at the composition of that group, it really is to deal with some of the policy issues of implementing the wolf plan from a livestock user or producer perspective and the environmental groups on lowering conflict as much as possible. As the issue evolves and we pick up and deal with wolf ungulate stuff, we suspect that the composition of that group will change and reflect that new policy concerns as we flesh out those issues.
Great. Commissioner Schmitten.
Thank you, Chair. And Donnie, does your report include any new information as far as numbers or mortality in both the Colville and Spokane reservations?
It does. We have contacted recently and talked with both the Colville and Spokane reservations, so the table that I showed is reflective of their annual report as well and the mortalities that they've documented over the same time period. We communicate with them fairly regularly on wolf issues and on the ground with trapping and monitoring and flights and all those kinds of things.
Any new packs identified?
No, not for 2013, not that we're aware of.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Well, let me ask you to talk with me a little bit more about this choice that we made this year not to try to estimate an overall population. I can't believe that our only algorithm might be number of packs times 8. We've got to have more sophisticated ability to extrapolate overall population numbers than just a simple arithmetic like that. But so I think this that you've explained this minimum number only rising by one issue that will definitely be raised by some of our stakeholders. But let's hear some more about why we're choosing not to try to estimate the overall population. Why? Because that is another thing that people expect us to stay on top of.
Good point, absolutely. We recognize that as well, which is providing an estimate. Right now, in terms of our effort and our resources and what we're doing, most of it is going into just keeping up with where colonization is occurring. One of the things that's on the horizon for us is going to be what you talked about, and that is more demographic data and estimates of population size and recruitment. And so it'll be things that you'll see in the draft upcoming game management plan that will have a chapter on wolves and the things we're going to be doing on the horizon. And you'll see things like patch occupancy modeling and demographics that we're estimating by capture, recapture, and those kinds of things. And so on the horizon is the more robust scientific means of estimating population size. The reason we chose not to go there this year is it then just sets us up for also those discussions about, let's say we were to use a different average pack size because we thought 8 was too high, because we know that several of the packs are 2. Well, what's the right average? Is it the average from just last year in Washington, or is it the average from Washington, Oregon, or Idaho? And so it just sets us up again for it's more arbitrary, and we didn't want to do that.
Okay. Any other comments? It's just one of the most interesting subjects that we deal with on a daily basis. So terrific work, Stephanie. Wonderful job.
You.
Yeah, you convey your enthusiasm so professionally that it gives me a lot of confidence that we are doing everything we can, given our resources, to manage the conflict. So terrific job. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Okay.